Good morning. We'll call the meeting to order this morning of the House Agriculture Policy Committee. In today's agenda, we will be introducing the department's policy bill, House File 1717. We don't have a quorum here yet to move the bill. So I think we'll start just going over the bill, unless the quorum gets here very quickly. We have the House file itself and a DE2 amendment. So again, okay, we do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order and take care of minutes. Representative Mahoney approves the minutes of the...
I read them and understand them entirely. Great. I think they're great.
March 1st minutes, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Thank you. And now I would move the Department Bill, House File 1717, and also move the DE2 amendment. And before we take questions on that, I think we'll call on the House Research to go over some of the provisions in the DE2 amendment. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, working from the DE2 amendment, the first section was proposed by the Department of Agriculture in House File 1717 as introduced. Current law exempts from the requirement that agencies provide advisory inspections. Certain inspections performed by the Dairy and Food Inspection Division within the department. Section 1 would remove that exemption. On page 4 is Section 2, also from House File 1717. This begins a series of sections pertaining to pesticide. You see new definitions proposed for experimental use permit, experimental use pesticide product, as those terms are used within current law and in future sections in the bill. Section 4 at the bottom of page 4 provides a registration exemption for certain substances and mixtures that do not require a federal permit and are used only to test a pesticide's efficacy or its toxicity or other properties. Those products would not be required to be registered with the Commissioner of Agriculture. Similar on Section 5 for experimental use pesticide products, similar exemption language would be inserted there as well. Section 6, also pesticide, it changes the information that an applicant must provide to the department when pursuing a experimental use pesticide product registration. Bottom of page 6, Section 7, these would be new notification requirements when a structural pesticide applicator applies pesticide in an occupied apartment. Bottom of page 7, these are extensions of the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council. Section 8 is a retroactive extension of the council itself. Section 9 is an extension of the grant program that the council oversees. I don't have the House file number for this one, but members will remember hearing this bill earlier in the session. On page 8, the top section 10, this is back to language proposed by the department, and these next sections pertain to nursery stock. Section 10 provides an exemption from the licensing requirement, a certificate requirement for municipalities that sell certain nursery stock for specific purposes. The next section, Section 11, is pretty technical. It specifies that late fees will be assessed if nursery grower certificates are not renewed or electronically date stamped by December 31st. Similar change in Section 12 for nursery stock dealers and the renewal of those certificates. On page 10, begins a series of sections recommended by the department pertaining to seed potatoes. In general, these sections would authorize the department to regulate seed potatoes that are grown in a laboratory rather than in the field. So those sections are sections 13, 14, 15, and 16.
Mr. Sullivan, if I could pause you just a second. We have an example of some of these tiny, tiny seed potatoes in this test tube. If we pass those around so you can see what we're talking about with that provision. Go ahead, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, then on page 11, section 17, begins a series of sections recommended by the department pertaining to commercial feed law. Section 17 is a very technical, sort of a grammatical change. Section 18 is the definition of commercial feed. There are some relatively, appear to me, technical changes there pertaining to exemptions for unmixed whole seeds or physically altered unmixed seeds that are not labeled for use as feed or for use as feed. Section 19 on page top of page 12 would modify the definition of manufacture for commercial feed to include packaging or labeling of feed for distribution. Section 12 authorizes the Department of Agriculture to designate an agent or to appoint an agent rather than a designated representative for purposes of enforcing commercial feed law. Section 21 provides that each guarantor of commercial feed must have a commercial feed license if their name will appear on the label of a commercial feed as the guarantor. Section 22, also commercial feed, again, it has to do with when renewal applications have to be submitted to the department in order to avoid late penalties. The bottom of page 12, section 23, affects the information that must be on the label of a commercial feed other than a customer formula feed. See on page 14, line 14.12, feeds would now require a quantity statement on the label. Section 24 has to do with good manufacturing practices certificates requested from the department for commercial feed and feed ingredients. This section is fairly technical and reflects the fact that in the repealer, the rest of the subdivisions in this section that establish the standards the department uses when determining whether a person can receive a good manufacturing practice certificate are met. Because those standards and law would be repealed, there's a technical change to fix the references within this section 24. On page 15, section 25 has to do with the registration of small packages of pet food or specialty pet food. My understanding of this change and some changes that follow is that these small packages of food would now need to be registered rather than, under current law, providing a listing of such packages to the department. Section 26, ill commercial feed. This modifies the exemptions, the fee exemptions, the inspection fee for commercial feed, to provide that a feed ingredient in a customer formula feed that was provided by the customer themselves is not subject to the fee. And if there are changes to the fees and when they're assessed on distributions made to qualified buyers outside of the state. On section, bottom of page 16, section 27, this is where you'll see language changing a requirement currently to provide a listing of pet food and specialty pet food that's sold only in small packages. There would be a requirement now to register those products with the department. On page 17, section 28, see more language specifying when certain documents are due to the department to avoid a late fee. Section 29, extremely technical change. Section 30, it appears to provide that if the department adopts both official definitions of feed ingredients and also official feed terms from the Association of American Feed Control Officers, then any changes to those terms or ingredient or definitions would be automatically incorporated into state law unless the department acts to stop that. Section 31 is authorizes the department to appoint an agent to perform inspections on behalf of the department, commercial feed. Section 32 is very technical, change to language, update some of the language in that section. Section 33, 34, 35, 36 are continuation of appear to be relatively small changes to feed law. On page 20, you see we leave the commercial feed area in section 37 on page 20. The section has to do with wholesale produce dealers, and it would reduce the amount of information, the type of information that applicants must provide to the department when pursuing a license as a wholesale produce dealer. On page 21, section 38, we provide a new definition for the term regularly engaged. This term is used in current law for a license exemption that exists for certain religious, charitable, and educational, and some other organizations that are not in the food business. So this would provide some guidance as to how that term is interpreted when the department is considering whether to exempt a certain entity from the requirement to obtain a food handler license. Section 39 is an extension for 10 years of the existing Food Safety and Defense Council. Section 40 has to do with meat and poultry inspections and eliminates the restriction that animals for purposes of inspections are only large domesticated animals, so the department would have authority to regulate domesticated animals of any size used for human food. Section 41 on the bottom of page 21 is from House File 686. This has to do with the dairy authority. Members will remember these sections from the standalone bill essentially eliminate the requirement that the authority itself must acquire a site for dairy research, extension, and education, and provides that the list of mandatory facility features, that if certain features are not practical, then they would not be required to be part of the facility. On page 22, section 42 is also dairy authority. It extends into the future for 3 years the authority's existence and provides that if the authority by August 1st, 2020 is not identified a site for the facility, then the authority's authority to operate would disappear and the statute would expire. Bottom of page 22 starts a series of sections that affect the Rural Finance Authority loan programs and the maximum net worth that borrowers can have when qualifying for the program. Section 43 is a change to the Restructure 2 loan program that RFA administers. On 23.9, members will see that the net worth limitation would increase from $660,000 as of 2014 to $1.7 million in 2017. So that $660,000 figure has increased due to inflation over the years. So it's not $660,000 currently, but the increase with this bill would be to $1.7 million of net worth for eligible borrowers. On page 23, then section 44 is a comparable change to the beginning farmer loan program. Net worth limit would increase from $350,000 in 2004 to $800,000 in 2017. On page 24, section 45 is for the Ag Improvement Loan Program. The increase is on 24.8 to 24.9. Section 46, Livestock Expansion Loan Program, changes on 24.17. Section 47 is the Aggie Bond Loan Program. Net worth changes on 24.28. On page 25, section 48 begins a series of sections that have to do with the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. These are from House File 1047. Section 48 lifts the restriction that AURI provide financial and technical assistance only to Minnesota entrepreneurs. Section 48 expands the AURI Board of Directors by adding two at-large representatives. Section 50 would remove the requirement that AURI provide research grants to public and private educational institutions. Section 51 on page 27 would provide that the Board of Directors of AURI must hire only the Executive Director, not all of the Institute staff. Section 52 on page 27 is a change to where the AURI must post its bylaws and any amendments to those bylaws. Section 53 would allow the Board of Directors of AURI to conduct telemeetings. Section 54 affects the conflict of interest standard for AURI. Currently, a director or employee or officer of AURI may not participate in a voter decision if they have a direct financial or indirect financial interest. This change would say that the person may participate but cannot advocate for the voter decision. On page 28, section 55, this changes the dollar limit on expenditures and receipts that must receive board approval. Section 56 changes the annual audit for AURI. Did not require AUI would no longer be required to have an audit from the legislative auditor, but would instead provide and pay for an annual audit by an independent audit firm. Section 57 is back to recommendations from the Department of Agriculture in House File 1717 as introduced. The section has to do with grain buyer bonds. See on page 29, lines 29.7 to 29.9, the change has to do with the disbursement process for grain buyer bonds. So when the grain buyer is unable to pay farmers for grain that it has that it is holding on behalf of the farmers, this process on line 29.7 to 29.9 would require the department to provide notice and then to initiate bond payments after 200 days. Very similar language appears in section 58 for public grain warehouse operators and their bonds. That language is on 30.3 to 30.5. And section 59 has to do with the Farmer Lender Mediation Act from House File 1511. That language continues. Well, you can see the language in these first few sections is the language that increases the current debt threshold for Farmer Lender Mediation Act from $5,000 to $15,000. So that language is on pages 31, 32, and the top of 33. And then section 63 would extend the Farmer Lender Mediation Act by 4 years to June 30th, 2022. Section 64 is the new exemption from Farmer Lender Mediation Act requirements for new debt issued by a creditor to a farmer as a result of mediation. Section 65 is the actual increase to $15,000, and this language is rewritten a bit from House File 1511 as introduced because of comments that it was a bit hard to understand as drafted originally. So it's drafted now kind of following the model from the RFA net worth statutes that members saw before. Page 66, these are all changes that members heard in House File 1511. I can go through them in detail if members would like, but it's about these changes are intended to require the farmer to be prepared fully for the first meeting with creditors by having all financial and inventory information in place. Also authorizes University of Minnesota Extension to pull the farmer's credit report and identify any creditors that the farmer omitted when filing for mediation. So this Farmer Lender Mediation Act changes continue on 35, 36, section 69, section 70 on page 37, section 71 on page 38. There was another change from the language that the committee heard, and it had to do with the necessary living expenses, the amount that creditors, thank you, the creditors are required to release to farmers during mediation so they can pay their necessary living expenses. That's on page 38, lines 38.24 to 38.28. Under current law, the amount the creditor is required to release is the lesser of $1,600 or 1.5 times the amount the farmer's family would receive if they were eligible for Minnesota Family Assistance Program payments. The language, the DE amendment would eliminate the MFIP component in current law and provide that necessary living expenses, as you see on line 38.25, are limited to $3,600 per month. And then there's a requirement to adjust that amount in 2022 and every 5 years thereafter for inflation based on the All Items Consumer Price Index. On page 39, section 72 is a technical revisor's instruction that has to do with the creation of some new definitions in the pesticide chapter of law. The repealer on page 73, Minnesota Statute Section 18B.01 Subdivision 10A, is an existing definition in pesticide law for genetic engineering. 10B is a definition of genetically engineered pesticide. 22A is a definition of release of a genetically engineered pesticide outside of the laboratory into the environment. 18B.285 is a section of law that currently requires the registration of experimental genetically engineered pesticides. Section 25.371, and the subdivisions there are the ones I referenced earlier. They provide the standards that the department uses when evaluating an applicant's request for a good manufacturing practices certificate for commercial feed. And 583.22 subdivision B is the Farmer Lender Mediation Act definition of necessary living expenses that includes the 150% of MFIP component. Sorry, 41D.01 is the expiration of MALC, the Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council. So with this repealer, MALC would be extended indefinitely and would not have a sunset date. That's the end of Article 1. If members have questions, you can pause here. I'll continue with Article 2.
Any questions from members? If not, I thought I had one marked a ways back. But I no, I don't. See no questions. Go ahead, Mr. Sullivan, with the next part.
Article 2 is titled Dairy Law Reorganization. This is recommended by the department as a way to reorganize, recodify existing dairy laws currently in Chapter 32, and they would be reorganized and coded now in Chapter 32D. I don't know how much detail members would like me to go in here. I think I'll move relatively quickly because, in general, this is a reorganization of a restatement of existing law. The first section has to do with data practices, and as per my reading of current law and the proposal in this bill, the classification of the financial and production information the department obtains would be treated the same, so there'd be no change in how the data is handled for data practices purposes. Section 2 provides definitions for terms, significant terms that are used throughout this new chapter. Section 3 provides inspection authority and establishes duties for the Department of Agriculture to provide inspections, license, certify certain entities involved in the dairy industry. That section is long and continues on page 42 through 43. On page 44, section 4 provides standards for those who haul milk from a dairy farm to a processing plant, and those people apparently also pull samples and take those samples to laboratories to test for quality and adulteration of the milk. So people who provide that service need a license under current law would also hear under section 4. Section 5 provides requirements to obtain a permit for milk tank trucks. On page 45, section 6 has to do with grade A dairy farms and the water wells used at those farms. It appears the language, this language from current law that would appear again on 45.7 through 45.14, it appears to grandfather in certain wells and farms that were in place when the department adopted new standards related to water wells on dairy farms through rulemaking. Section 7 has to do with grade A dairy farms, how often they must be inspected, be once every 6 months. The fees in this section, and according to my analysis of all the sections here, the fees are the same as under current law. Grade A dairy farm inspection would be no more than $50 per farm. And as under current law, these fees are paid not by the farm itself, the dairy farm, but by the processor or the marketing organization on behalf of the farmers. And then Section 8 has to do with not grade A, but other milk that's not sold as grade A, referred to throughout these sections alternatively as manufacturing or grade B dairy. So these farms required not to be licensed, have to be licensed but certified. And on page 9, you see the inspection of these dairy farms would be every 12 months. Those that produce milk for manufacturing purposes, and a fee is established for that purpose. Section 10 has to do with the requirement that dairy plants are licensed and permitted by the Department of Agriculture, including their floor plans for new construction or alterations. Limits on who can call their products farmstead cheese, they would have to meet the definition in this new chapter, which matches the definition, I believe, in current law. And that's that the cheese is produced on the same farm where the milk was produced. Section 11 on page 47 talks about the frequency of grade A and manufacturing grade dairy plant inspections. Every 3 months for grade A plants, every 6 months for manufacturing grade. Section 12 is the procurement fee paid by dairy plant operators of 1.1 cent per hundredweight of milk purchased. Section 13 has to do with payments made by manufacturers, those who produce products from fluid milk or milk used in manufacturing. This is the fees that they pay to the department. Section 14 provides milk quality standards for bacteria, for coliform count, for somatic cell count, and temperature for milk in the state. Section 15 requires official producer samples for each producer to be analyzed for the bacteria, somatic cell count, temperature at least once a month and four out of every 6 months. Section 16 requires monthly reporting by dairy plants that procure milk from producers. Section 17 is enforcement, the enforcement actions the department can take. Section 18 requires certification or approval of laboratories that test milk for purposes of the regulations in this chapter. Section 19 provides the testing methods and payment formulas for milk that's purchased from dairy producers, and a series of penalties for actions that manipulate the results of tests. These would all be misdemeanors, as you see on line 51.25. Section 20 prohibits selling adulterated dairy products. Dairy products, for purposes of milk, adulteration is defined on 52.3 to 52.10. There are prohibitions against drug residues in the milk as well. Penalties for violating those prohibitions. That continues through page 53. Page 51 generally requires all products, milk or fluid milk products sold, to be pasteurized, but retains the existing exemption in law that provides that a person can occasionally secure or purchase for their own personal use non-pasteurized milk directly from the farm or place where the milk is produced. Section 22 pertains to requirements for cooling after pasteurization. Section 23 provides that in general all cheese must be produced from pasteurized milk. Section 24 is similar to current law and has to do with milk product that's labeled, or dairy products that are labeled as coming from cows that were not treated with recombinant bovine growth hormone. On page 56, then section 25, section 26, section 27, section 28, and section 29 are recodification of the existing Dairy Trade Practices Act that requires, in general, selling dairy products below cost. And then the final section 30, is the repealer, and that would repeal all sections currently in Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 33.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Very in-depth report and a lot of things to go over. Again, any questions from members on what Mr. Sullivan just presented to us? Seeing none, I'd like to call up the department if they could come down for a while and go over some of the highlights that they see in the bill and answer any questions that members may have. Good morning. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Whitney Place. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs at the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, do you want me to go through our items?
Yes.
Okay, well, first I want to thank you, Chair Anderson, for moving forward many of the department's policy requests. We put forward a very large policy bill, and we're grateful for the time that you took to work with us on it. I do have a number of our staff here if there are really technical or specific questions, so feel free to ask us anything. So included in the delete all amendment was the removal of the advisory inspection language. The Dairy and Food Inspection Division no longer exists. We broke that division into two divisions a couple of years ago, and we typically don't conduct these types of advisory inspections. It should be noted that both divisions are still allowed to conduct these inspections as described under Minnesota Statute 15.985, so people can still request those from us if needed. The establishment of the experimental pesticide use permit was included in the delete all amendment. The current section for pesticide experimental use registration in Minnesota statute doesn't clearly establish when this registration is necessary and what the application should consist of. And this also aligns our experimental use better with the US EPA guidelines. Pesticide use notification requires that a structural pest control applicator provides an after pesticide use to an apartment dweller, notification to an apartment dweller, and we feel that this language is really important to make sure that the apartment dweller can comply with the requirements that are on the label in terms of, you know, not preparing food on a surface that has been exposed to pesticides, etc.
Ms. Place, we've seen this attempts at this kind of a legislation in the past. Does there seem to be agreement this time around from the parties involved that would be affected by this statute?
Thanks for bringing that up, Mr. Chair. Yes. Last session, I believe the language had a requirement to post something in a general area, and this is more specific to the unit that the resident lives in, notifying that resident. And we've worked with the stakeholders to develop this language, so there should be consensus.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
The nursery staff dealer certificate exemption for cities. Many cities conduct nursery sales, typically around Arbor Day, to sell nursery stock at or below cost to their residents for boulevard trees and other uses. So this would exempt them from actually having to obtain a nursery stock dealer certificate, and they would be able to sell that stock for a period of 10 days. The potato microtuber certification establishment, you all saw the microtubers. This is a new way of propagating potatoes for potato propagation instead of using seeds, and MDA inspects seed potatoes to make sure that they're free of viruses. And so this would put in language the same requirements for microtubers as well. You know, we had the commercial feed chapter, which was very long and technical, but we really feel like that'll be more citable. It's written more clearly and in plain language, so our regulated parties will be able to understand it better. The Food Safety and Defense Task Force extension is very important, and I know that has been heard in another bill. So thank you for including that in the delete all. We feel it's very important to also include the Rural Finance Authority net worth limit increases. These increased limits were determined from the Minnesota farm income data reported by the USDA, and we feel they better capture the landscape in terms of where farmers' net worths are, so that they can be eligible for the RFA loans. Thank you also for your consideration of the dairy chapter. We feel that this will be a much more organized way for our regulated dairy parties to be able to cite statute and to be able to understand the complicated state and federal rules. Mr. Chair, I also wanted to thank you for the amended language to the farmer lender mediation family living expenses. This language in this delete all amendment better reflects the intentions of the farm lender mediation task force, so thank you. The department does have a concern that the delete all amendment strips the bill of language intended to protect pollinators. This language came as a recommendation from MDA's Special Registration Review of Neonicotinoids that found that this class of chemicals does have a negative impact on honeybee and native bee populations. The department intends to address these issues in a fair and balanced way that protects both Minnesota farmers and the important ag economy that they support, as well as pollinators. So I urge members to take this language into consideration as well, and offer to continue the dialogue about this important issue.
Thank you, Ms. Boyce. Any questions from members? I had one, Ms. Boyce, on all of the dairy law reorganization. Were there any actual changes made in terms of the fees that farmers pay, or regulations and inspections every 6 months or every 12 months? Did they all basically stay the same?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they're all the same.
Okay. Thank you very much. Seeing no questions, we'll move to testifiers. We have a list. And first up is Daniel Rachel. I hope I got that correct. Mr. Mr. Reif will come on down. Then we have Carmen Fernholz and Lex Horan, who will be on deck. Good morning, sir. Identify yourself to the committee and begin your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Dan Rochelle, and I'm an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And on behalf of our 40,000 members and online activists in the state of Minnesota, I am speaking today in support of language in the original introduced draft of HF 1717 that will help Minnesota farmers and beekeepers by closing a legal loophole for pesticide-treated seed. Bees and other pollinators are key contributors to Minnesota's agricultural economy. Bees are directly responsible for more than $33 million in state agricultural products and also significantly improve the yield, diversity, and quality of hundreds of millions of other agricultural products in the state. All in all, 85% of Minnesota's crops benefit from bee pollination, which is why it is particularly alarming that in the 2014-2015 season, Minnesota beekeepers lost more than half of their bee colonies. These staggering losses result from a number of factors, but a growing body of research shows that the widespread use of neonicotinoid insecticides, or neonics, is likely a major contributor. Neonics are classified as highly toxic to bees, and even in low doses, they have been shown to impair a bee's immune system, memory, and ability to find food. Recognizing growing concerns, this legislature charged the Department of Agriculture to study the issue. And after more than 2 years of careful study, the department came to an important conclusion. They need the tools to know more. That's because neonics don't work like traditional pesticides. As systemic pesticides, neonics are designed to dissolve in water and be taken up into the plant itself, making the plant, its pollen, and its nectar toxic to insects. For this reason, they can be applied to a crop seed, and then the plant will absorb the neonics as it grows. And in fact, this is the primary way they are used. The department, however, doesn't have authority over treated seeds because of a loophole in the state's pesticide laws. This loophole treats the use of pesticide-coated seeds differently than other pesticide applications, even though in the real world, the effect is the same. Accordingly, what we are asking for today is not a singling out of neonics or any other pesticide. We are simply calling for equal treatment for pesticides that come attached to seeds to be treated the same way as any other pesticide. We also support the authorization of the department to track treated seeds sold by distributors into the state of Minnesota and to work with the University of Minnesota on research, demonstration projects, and best management practices. None of these common sense steps are radical. It is, however, insupportable to allow continued special treatment for a whole class of pesticides and to keep the department hamstrung in its ability to address an issue that may have a profound effect on 85% of the state's agricultural products. We need bees, and that's why we ask the committee to respect the opinion and expertise of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture by closing the loophole for pesticide seed treatments and supporting the department's treated seed program. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Rochelle? I had one, sir. You said this was a loophole in state law, but isn't it federal law that puts seed treatment in a class different from other pesticides?
The state law mimics the loophole in the federal law, but federal law is only designed to set a floor for regulation. The state has the ability to go beyond that, and in this circumstance, it makes complete sense, especially because when the law was written, these type of pesticides did not exist. The federal law didn't comprehend that you could have a pesticide that would be applied to a seed and then drawn up into the plant as it grows.
That would be a systemic insecticide.
A systemic insecticide,
yeah.
Right. It just needs an update.
Any of the states, have they done this?
To my knowledge, I don't know every state law. I don't believe that every state law mimics the exception in the federal law. A number of states do, but a lot of that is just by default as opposed to on purpose.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Rochelle. Next up is Carmen Fernholz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
I'm here to testify in favor of the...
Could you please identify yourself?
Yes. My name is Carmen Fernholz. And I'm here to testify in favor of the treated seed program, which has been deleted in the current version of the bill. wife Sally and I operate a 410-acre field cropping farm near Madison, Minnesota. We started farming in 1972 and were first certified organic in 1975. I also work in collaboration with the University of Minnesota on farm research as well as organic cropping systems consulting, transition consulting. I'm also a member of the Southwest Minnesota Farm Business Management Association. Farmers as well as legislators, especially rural Minnesota legislators, should welcome research studies to further define and clarify the impacts of insecticides, including neonicotinoids, on the pollinator population, both wild and domestic species. Some of us may be asked to do more. And because we are given more responsibility as the caretakers of our agriculture, land, environment, and ecosystem, more is expected of us as leaders in our society. It is my understanding that currently we in Minnesota do not have a solid number on actual amounts of the neonicotinoid that is in total use, as the product applied to seed is not part of the data collection process. Current data available, if I am correct, puts the amount of neonicotinoid usage at less than 2% of total pesticide usage. If this percentage is accurate and it excludes seed treatment application, are we really being honest and robust in our assessment of neonicotinoids' ubiquitousness and impact on the environment? To me, monitoring the environment would seem to be a never-ending work in progress. In this day of continued technological advancement and the ability to study more closely the intricacies of our environment, robust ongoing engagement would seem to be a logical, intelligent choice. I think we need to ask ourselves why we would want to continue to harbor the current loophole in the pesticide oversight legislation. If there is an issue, let's at least be willing to confront the concern with as much knowledge and information as we can generate. This action certainly is not a ban on the insecticide. It is seeking more robust information on which to make even more sound decisions by farmers and other economists, environmentalists concerned with the environment. It is in our endeavor to seek ways to use this insecticide even more judiciously as we are made ever more aware of the impacts or lack thereof on insects, especially pollinators. If there are negative impacts, suspected, perceived, or real, that are occurring from the use of the neonicotinoids, these impacts will continue to evolve. They will not go away just because we choose to not seek a deeper understanding of them. Denial is really not an option. Not participating in a discussion of a potentially regulated issue seems not to be leadership. Someone once told me, if you are not at the table, you will be on the menu. Consider the many years of research studies and data collecting needed to develop the current safety protocols in place today for all the pesticides being used in agriculture, from optimum application times and rates to proper protective clothing. These protocols are still being developed and refined. My question to this body is, how do we know we have equally as robust protocols in place for protection of the many beneficial insects and birds in our environment? I submit to you that establishing these protocols is much more challenging for the simple reason that most of what we eventually put in place for protection are reactive rather than protective actions. Much is being written in major farm publications regarding the growing awareness and interest in consumers connecting the food they buy to the farmers on the land, how it is being grown, what means of production are involved. It would seem to me that any further clarification that we can provide in the way of assurances that what we as farmers are actually doing is absolutely safe to both the consumer and the environment, and would go a long way in building stronger relationships. So in conclusion, if we as farmers really believe that we are, in fact, the environmentalists that we say we are, then I would think that we would surely want to know that the top crop production practices we are carrying out on our farms are the best management practices. It hardly seems possible that we can make these claims if they are serious and viable doubts. And I thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Bernholtz. Any questions from members? I had one, sir. I was given some information by some folks, and I read it, and I recall that the quarterly population counts are taken of bees, and is it true that the highest mortality occurs in the late summertime? Did I read that correctly? Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with that. I'm not a beekeeper, so I would defer to a beekeeper on that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you much.
Thank you. Maybe somebody else can help us with that as we move along. Next is Lex Horan, Pesticide Action Network. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. And we will have a beekeeper testifying later who I think can speak to that question.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Lex Horan, and I work with Pesticide Action Network. We work alongside rural communities, beekeepers, family farmers, and other communities who are concerned about the impacts of pesticides on their livelihoods or on their health. As we've heard from other testifiers, as we'll hear from others still today, our pollinators here in Minnesota are in serious decline. Beekeepers are losing, on average in Minnesota, between 40% and 50% of their colonies every year. And as the beekeepers that I talk with often say, there's no business model in which you can lose half of your product every year and still be a viable operation. Similarly, our native bees here in Minnesota, we've got more than 400 species of native bees, and they're also at risk. This matters significantly for our state's agricultural economy. In 2015, there was a study conducted that maps out the decline of native bees in every county in the United States. And the researchers compared the decline with the crops in each county that depend on pollination or benefit from that pollination. And they found that Minnesota was one of the states that had the greatest mismatch. That is, the lowest number of native bees per county compared with the greatest need of pollinators on cropland. Second, the science that's linking pesticides with this pollinator decline is quite clear. In January 2015, an international body of scientists reviewed more than 1,000 studies on the issue on the impact of neonicotinoids and fipronil on a variety of species. And it included only peer-reviewed studies, and it did include studies funded by the pesticide industry. And it found that neonicotinoids and fipronil are highly toxic to all bee species tested so far, and that the body of evidence reviewed in the Worldwide Integrated Assessment indicated that the current scale of use of neonicotinoids and fipronil is not a sustainable pest management approach. And closer to home, of course, we've had some excellent science as well from the Department of Agriculture on this issue in their more than 2-year review of neonicotinoids, which I won't reiterate because we've already talked about it this morning. Of course, pesticides are not the only cause of pollinator decline. We need to tackle the issue of loss of good forage, climate change, diseases and parasites, which all have a role to play. Luckily, Minnesota is doing great work on all of those fronts. But as international bodies and our own state agency have found, the evidence linking neonicotinoids with pollinator decline is quite strong. And so if we don't reduce pollinator exposure to pesticides, we'll really have a difficult time solving this issue. And so the question to me that I see facing our state is, what will we do now to turn the tide on this decline? This legislation that was proposing the treated seed program that has now been eliminated is a clear and productive step that really does just help our state agencies and researchers at the University of Minnesota better understand how neonic treated seeds are used in our state. It's based on a commitment to transparency and a sound science. It's not a rash political decision. It gives us more tools to solve the problem in partnership with researchers and farmers. If after a vote today, this committee does not support the creation of this program to better understand the use of seed treatments in our state, I do hope that members of this body and others will offer a different proposal that is rigorous enough to match the severity of the crisis facing our pollinators. As I've gotten the chance to talk with many of you, I know it's an issue of concern for all of us here. Such a solution does need to tackle all of the factors contributing to the decline, including pesticide exposure, and it needs to move quickly given the severity of the issue. Our agricultural economy depends on it. Thank you.
Any questions? I have one.
Sure.
I've done a lot of reading on this topic, and it's an important topic, and I think I shared this with some of your folks, and I took it off a farm marketing DTM thing, but it was a study released, I think, within the last month by the EPA, where they said that the neonicotinoids were not a lethal killer of bees. Now, you're saying that highly toxic. I think they said that at sublethal doses they can have a effect that, accumulates, but the EPA study said that it was not a lethal killer. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, there, of course, the EPA review is complex. There's a lot that's in there. And I think some of the concerns that we have with the EPA review that are better tackled in a couple of the other studies that I referenced are, first, the impact on native bees. EPA really focuses a lot of its framework on the impacts on honeybees because, of course, that's where most of the data is. But luckily, more and more data of the impact of pesticides on native bees is becoming available. And many of those native bees, as I think we'll hear from other testifiers, are more sensitive. And so that's one area where EPA's assessment is falling a bit short. Another is in the issue of seed treatments in particular. EPA has begun to take up the issue of seed treatments, but has not done a full assessment of the impacts on, for example, seed treatments in soybeans on pollinators yet. And so because that is the most widespread use, we think that is, you know, a missed opportunity to really understand the impact on the landscape. And the third piece I'll mention is that a lot of EPA's protections really focus on areas in which there's a honeybee colony under contract for pollination. So where there's a grower, like an almond grower, for example, or an apple grower who has contracted with a beekeeper to have their bees on their property for crop pollination services. And although that is a critical part of our food system and one of the main ways that honeybees are in use in our food system, that those protections don't protect those honeybees the rest of the year when they're in a state like Minnesota where they're not as often under contract, but they're foraging for honey production and foraging on other habitat. And it also, again, doesn't protect our native bees. So I think EPA is doing some very important work, and of course we want to stay in coordination, but I think there are some opportunities that EPA is missing that we can tackle at the state level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seeing no questions, we'll move on to our next testifier, Christy Allen, and then Lori Cox and Pamela Barone. Good morning. Identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christy Allen, and I'm here today to testify in support of the pesticide seed treatment program. I'm a beekeeper, an educator, and a small business owner based out of Minneapolis. I manage around 100 honeybee hives for honey and education in five counties in Minnesota and western Wisconsin. My uncle is a commercial beekeeper from northern Minnesota who manages around 1,000 hives for honey production and pollination services. In the 7 years of managing my own hives, I have reported 2 bee kills to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I underwent investigations in 2013 and 2015. Both of those investigations proved that my bees were killed due to the use of systemic pesticides. The bee kill in 2013 that happened in Minneapolis motivated me to testify 5 times in 2014 for pollinator-friendly bills that became law. If you voted for those bills, thank you. One of the bills that passed in 2014 was a beekeeper compensation bill. In May of 2015, I experienced my second pesticide kill as a result of dust from a corn planting in Scandia, Minnesota. The landowner was on her tractor cutting hay. She saw the farmer planting corn and that evening noticed the bees dying in front of the hive. After an investigation with the MDA, myself and the landowners who also had bees on the property received compensation for our dead bees because of the legislation that was passed in 2014. The document I provided for you all today explains the results of that bee kill investigation, and they are clear. Our bees in Scandia died that day from the dust from pesticide seed treatments. The dust from that planting was so plentiful that the dandelions surrounding the field, which native bees, not only my honeybees, feed on, had high levels of clothianidin, which is a neonicotinoid, the chemical coated on that corn seed. Our 9 hives were not right next to the field, but set back 100 yards behind a tree line, and we still found dust from the planting on their bodies. I talked to a lot of beekeepers, and I have attended several conferences both statewide, and this year I was invited to speak at the National Beekeeping Meeting in Galveston, Texas. Almost every beekeeper has a pesticide kill experience. Many witnessed dead bees in front of their hives during corn planting. Having hives in 5 counties, I can tell you that the places where the bees are least exposed to fields planted with pesticide-seeded seeds do much better than those that are closer to them. and can also tell you that there are fewer and fewer places safe places for bees. Studies have found neonics in the water, the soil, as well as wildflowers and other plants, affecting the health of many species in our ecosystems. Seed treatments are now the most widespread use of neonics, and we know that they are killing the very animals responsible for pollinating our food. Before I started my business, for most of my working career, I worked in restaurants and other establishments that until the mid-late 2000s had smoking sections. I worked at the Bingo Emporium in St. Cloud, Minnesota, where I grew up. The Bingo Emporium was in a large hall with a smoking and a non-smoking section. But even in the non-smoking section, everyone sat in the same room breathing the same air, which was filled with smoke. I was in charge of selling concessions and pull tabs. A few of the customers I served had holes in their throats and spoke by holding a microphone. The state of Minnesota was one of the first states to restrict smoking in the 1970s. Over 40 years later, there are very few places left where smoking is allowed indoors and even within a certain amount of feet from the building. We know that smoke doesn't stay in the smoking section and can harm people nearby. Speaking as a beekeeper, our options for keeping healthy bees are becoming precarious every year. The situation we are facing as a community of beekeepers, farmers, and consumers reminds me of secondhand smoke. We need to look at it as a public health crisis. Without pollinators, the price of food and the access to anything healthy will be untenable. The bees and many other insects and animals, as well as humans, are exposed to the dangers of these toxins, not by choice, but because of their widespread use without the information and policies we need to manage them responsibly. The science is clear that pesticide seed treatments harm pollinator health. We are all in this together as people who need clean food, water, and soil to be healthy. We need a treated seed program like the one proposed to understand the use of seed treatments in our state and to protect pollinators, our water, and our food system. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions?
I can answer the one about, Mr. Chair, about the beekeepers losing their hives in the fall. So commercial beekeepers like my uncle, they travel to California and they pollinate almonds and then they come back in the springtime with their bees and to make a honey crop. Oftentimes, the buildup of disease and exposure to pesticides will be so overwhelming that in the fall, after the bees produce honey, which takes a lot of energy from the bees, they will crash, meaning the bees will disappear and there's only a few left in the hive. And this is sort of what is referred to as CCD, colony collapse disorder.
Okay, thank you. But I would assume that the trip up to and from California, is that hard on bees also, the traveling that far and dislocation?
Yeah, the system of managing commercial honeybees is definitely hard on them as honeybees. And like Lex was saying before, what we should really look at more closely is the other species that don't have thousands and thousands of honeybees can have up to 70,000 bees, and they die every 4 to 6 weeks naturally. So they're constantly regenerating their populations. But other species, solitary bees, bumblebees, have a short window of opportunity. And if they're poisoned very early on, they will not be able to be biologically functional.
Thank you. One more question.
Yeah.
You talked about the bee kill in the area of a corn planter.
Mm-hmm.
What time of the year do you usually set your hives out?
Well, we personally, we don't move our hives out of the state at all. We leave them in the places and we what is called overwinter them, so we don't bring them to California. And that's a decision to not have that hard trip on them. It's also, when you bring your bees to the almond production, there's a lot of chemical use there as well, so you're exposing them to that as well as diseases that are spread by other bees. So ours, the ones that died that day had been there for over a year, and it was them just coming out of the hard winter, and the flowers were just starting to bloom, and then they got hit by that. All of those hives are now dead, and while the whole hive didn't perish that day, many, many of the bees did, and then the queens eventually failed. So they were ecologically dead after that moment.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
And my follow-up would be, I have a beekeeper who keeps bees in my pasture, and he tried, and he said, the last time I talked to him, a two-year experiment. 1 year he didn't put his, he must take his hives south or whatever.
Sure.
But he didn't put his hives out until after I had finished planting corn. Mm-hmm. In the next year, and he said that worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
The next year, it didn't work so well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a not a definitive, yes, this helps, no, this doesn't. So could you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, welcome to the very confusing world of beekeeping. Yeah, there are many things that can really negatively impact bees, and that's why it's so important that we look at every one of those issues very closely and do whatever we can to mitigate the damage. So bees also struggle from this parasitic mite called varroa, mm-hmm. and it's becoming harder and harder for us to manage that mite because the bees are weaker, their immune systems are weaker, and the studies that are coming out of many universities, especially the University of Minnesota, show how those sublethal effects will increase the chances for those bees to get certain diseases that they would normally be able to get through with the right nutrition.
Okay. Just a follow-up question with the mite. Do you treat the bees with a chemical for the mite, or how do you work to try to keep that down?
So we're smaller beekeepers, so we're able to do a lot more heavy management. So we do a lot of techniques that are management-based, and we treat only when absolutely necessary. We only use organic acids, which are approved organic beekeeping methods. Okay. But commercial beekeepers are stuck on a antibiotic train because if they don't treat, their bees will die, especially if they expose them to the almond pollination.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No questions again for Ms. Allen. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Lori Cox from the Roots Return Heritage Farm. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Lori Cox. I'm the owner and operator of Roots Return Heritage Farm. I'm pleased to be able to speak with you today and be heard in support of the current legislation. We're a small, sustainable, diversified crop farm in Carver. We're two parcels away from the Minnesota Valley National Wildlife Refuge in the southwest corner of the seven-county metro area. 2016 was our first production year where we grew and sold 20 types of vegetables and herbs, and we established 10 types of fruits. Over half our products were dependent on pollination. This year we plan on 30 crops, establishing wholesale accounts and on-farm educational events, including hosting field trips for our school district students next year. USDA NRCS webpage states one of three bites of food we eat exists because of animal pollinators. Our farm needs to be successful for us to earn a living, and we require pollinators. USDA Ag Census in 2012 stated ag production expenses went up significantly in 5 years, calling out the greatest increases of 66% for seeds and 63.4% for chemicals, while net cash farm income only rose 23.7%, not enough to cover that delta. I'd like to cite a recent presentation prepared for the 2017 Research Update for Ag Professionals. This was presented by Dr. Art Schaffsma, University of Guelph Entomology in Ontario, Canada, and Dr. Osley, University of Minnesota Extension Entomology, who is actually in attendance here today. Their presentation highlighted how pollinators are being exposed to neonics via the vacuum planter exhaust during cropland seeding. Pesticide drift content was occurring at a rate of 92 to 99% from seed coatings to pollinators around those fields. This is important to understand what can occur to our required pollinators. We fear this drift scenario will become a continuous problem on our farm too. If we are unable to attract enough pollinators for our products to sell, we will fail. We look to the Minnesota legislature to support our and numerous other farms by enabling this legislation to pass, allowing many different producers success when it comes on how they control pests for their crops and continue to make a living. This also enables you and your families to buy direct, visit your local farmers market, or pumpkin patch for years to come. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. I got questions from members? Kind of quiet today. Anyway. Ms. Cox, thank you for your testimony. And the last one we have on, at least on my list, is Pamela, and I'm sorry about this, parole. Okay. As she makes her way down, the game plan is to post this, take amendments, and then work on the bill. and hopefully pass it out of committee on Thursday, either during the day or in the evening on Thursday. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm reading this testimony. I'm
and your name, please.
Oh, sorry. My name is Pamela Hero. I'm reading this testimony on behalf of Sarah Folds Jordan, who couldn't be here today. She's a conservation specialist at the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation. My name is Pamela Hero. I also work for the Xerxes Society. Here's her testimony. As a pollinator conservation specialist with the Xerxes Society, I work with farmers across the Midwest to create and enhance habitat for pollinators and other beneficial insects on farms. In my experience, Minnesota has no shortage in farmers who are interested in planting habitat for pollinators, researchers who can attest to the benefit of this habitat both in terms of increased pollination services and increased natural pest control, restoration professionals who can design and install successful habitat plantings, and the native seed to support these plantings. However, where we do fall short in Minnesota is in safe places to plant habitat for pollinators that are protected from insecticide exposure. In order to better protect pollinators from insecticide drift and habitat contamination, we need to fully understand how and in what quantities neonicotinoid seed treatments are used in the state. Our Department of Agriculture needs to have the tools to track the use of treated seeds and work with farmers to take action on those findings. As such, we are pleased to see Minnesota considering creating a treated seed program in HF 1717, which we see as a common sense program that will close the federal loophole that makes neonicotinoid seed treatments exempt from regulation as a pesticide and give the Minnesota Department of Agriculture the ability to monitor and regulate these neonicotinoid seed treatments like other pesticides. We encourage the committee to keep the treated seed portion of the legislation in HF 1717. I'd like to call your attention to the document that was shared with you. If you turn over to the second page, you'll see a brief outline of some of the science illustrating the importance of this bill, including the fact that healthy insect populations are essential to agriculture. About two-thirds of crop plants and 35% of crop production is dependent on pollinators, and the value of pollination services in Minnesota is estimated at $11.8 million per year in apples alone. There's no lack of evidence that native pollinators are in decline. This includes six species of native bumblebees in Minnesota, most notably the rusty patch bumblebee, which has recently been listed as an endangered species. Researchers have found that neonicotinoids are increasingly prevalent in our landscape. Research has shown an upward trend in the use of neonicotinoid-coated seeds. It is estimated that more than 80% of corn and nearly 40% of soybeans are coated with neonics. There's also evidence that neonicotinoids pose serious risk to pollinators and other beneficial insects. While originally the planting of coated seeds was considered a low-risk use of pesticides, research is showing heavy costs from the growing trend of planting seeds pre-treated with systemic insecticides. Neonicotinoids are a priority concern because they are long-lived, highly toxic, and systemic, giving pollinators a direct route of exposure. And studies report minimal benefits from neonicotinoid seeds. In Minnesota, two crops that use neonic-coated seeds are corn and soybean. Recent governmental reviews have concluded limited efficacy from the planting of neonicotinoid-coated seed in soybean production. Because of a loophole in federal law, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture cannot currently gather good information on the use of neonicotinoid seed treatments in our state. This bill offers Minnesota a very small but critical step forward by providing the Minnesota Department of Ag with the ability to monitor and regulate neonic seed coatings in the same way that it manages all other pesticides applied in the state. We strongly support this bill and the advancements that it offers for pollinators in our state. Thank you for your time and attention to these concerns.
Thank you, ma'am. Again, questions, comments? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience who would care to testify on the bill? Seeing none. Again, the game plan here is to move ahead. And I would...
I'd like to testify.
Okay, come on down, ma'am. Give us your name, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
My name is Patricia Hauser. I'm from Sherwood, Minnesota. I grew up in Winona, Minnesota. And I'm with a group called Humming for Bees, co-founder of that group. And we were the first, we worked with the first city of Sherwood to pass a Bee Safe City resolution here in Minnesota. That was back, we organized in 2013, the end of 2013, began in 2014. And that bill was passed, or pardon me, the resolution was passed in 2014. That was 3 years ago. I have a few notes here, but I wasn't really planning on testifying, so I'm going to jump around a little bit, so please excuse me. I just want to say that the science is in that pollinators are in serious trouble. And you've heard that from our wonderful testifiers today. Now, when we need to do something different. We can't just go on with business as usual. And I want to say something regarding the coated seeds, because I don't think this was mentioned. Regarding the coated seeds themselves, according to a paper by the Center for Food Safety in September of 2015, only about 5% of the pesticide in the seed coating actually enters the growing plants. The other 95% is scraped, blown, sloughed off, or otherwise dispersed into the air and the soil and the water. And the USGS, the United States Geological Survey of 2015, reported finding neonicotinoids in about half the streams that they tested nationwide, and up to about 75% here in the Midwest. That's our water. As you heard, neonicotinoids are a neurotoxin. They affect the brain. That's why the bees can't forage. They can't find the way back to the hive. You know, they have difficulty remembering where the flowers were and how to do their waggle dance, all those things. We don't even know what's happening in our own water that we're drinking. This treated seed program is not a drastic measure. And I want to say something back here in Canada. In 2014, the EPA released findings that the neonicotinoid seed treatments produced no consistent increase in soybeans yield. Back in 2012, the European Union implemented a two-year moratorium on neonicotinoids, and Ontario, Canada, plans to reduce the use of neonicotinoid seed treatments by 80% in the next 2 years. Here in Minnesota, more than 25 communities, municipalities, counties, and school districts have passed policies to limit bee-harming pesticides. The Minnesota Department of Ag took about 2.5 years to study this. The governor, based on that information, issued executive report, or I forgot the exact title, executive report, anyway, that last August, trying to protect pollinators. Now, we need this treated seed program because we need the protection for our beekeepers, for our pollinators, our environment, the beekeepers, the farmers, the people in this state. I'm just going to ask you to please let the Department of Ag do their job. This is, seems like such a no-brainer. I don't get it. When I was young, we used to travel from Winona, Minneapolis to do, you know, see the big city, come to the Capitol. And there was always a time when we'd have to stop and wash the windshield because of all the bugs on the windshield. I can now go from Winona, which passed one of the resolutions, up to Duluth, which passed a resolution, and lots of cities in between that have passed resolutions, and municipalities or school districts, they know something, and not have to stop once to wash my car windshield. In fact, my understanding is that the Worldwide Integrated Assessment on Pesticides, when that was released, it was commissioned, that's an international group of scientists, independent scientists, not industry funded, but independent scientists who released that report. And they said that part of the reason for bringing it up was because they were having experiencing that same thing about the windshield. And they noticed insects disappearing. What they said in their report that I'm remembering also is that it not only affected our pollinators, but affected all kinds of other animals that depend on those pollinators, that eat them, for one thing, and that all the food, the wild animals that they take care of. So there are so many, it affected, in fact, ecosystems. This is so important. Please reconsider and make sure that that treat seed program is included in your bill. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Yeah, I guess I would have one. You and somebody else had mentioned that the studies have shown no advantage or yield advantage in soybeans, and I would agree with that. I don't treat my soybean seed with anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the jury is out there, but corn, there is a definite yield advantage with corn because the seed can be in the ground and eaten by insects and whatever. And I think that you can hardly buy seed corn in this state that's not treated. Right. And most of that is done, what I've been told, either in Iowa or Illinois, where the big seed corn companies are.
Mm-hmm.
And if the legislation was just to figure out how much neonic chemicals used on the seed corn, I think it's safe to say that probably 95% of the corn in this state is treated, seed corn is treated with the neonicotinoid. And to me, that would give us a ballpark figure that would be enough to satisfy what this legislation tries to do, is put a number on how much chemical we're actually using. So I think we can come up with a number. But I've also heard a couple of you say this legislation would monitor and then regulate. And I think that's what concerns people in agriculture, that the department would regulate, and I assume that to mean cut down the use of this chemical, at least as far as raising corn, is very necessary to maintain yield potential. Comment, ma'am.
Here's some things that come to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
One is, I think it's a real shame that 95% of the corn seed is treated, and that conventional farmers who don't want to use treated seeds don't even have a choice. In that case, it's hard for them to get the seeds. That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
And so I think that needs to be addressed. But another thing, there was something else I wanted to say.
I think if the demand is there, it will come. And organic, of course, is not treated. And
but it's more expensive.
Well, yeah, but it sells for a whole lot more, too, when they sell it.
Mm-hmm.
Those things all balance out. But anyway, go ahead.
I was going to add that the treated corn. Oh, you know, one of the things in the Worldwide Integrated Assessment, at the end of that, they had several recommendations. They recommended to governments around the world to limit, restrict, and actually, I think it was regulate or control the use of systemic insecticides, including, you know, neonics and fipronil, around the world immediately. They said this is so serious. They also said that they wondered why farmers were using this when we had proven methods of agriculture that worked so well for years and were very sustainable. But now we're having trouble growing, you know, without pesticide. And the other thing they said was to start teaching people about what they use in Europe. They have principles of precaution and prevention. And then they talked about, they'd like to also do a study and find out just why these pesticides are used in so many different places. I mean, why has this, you know, taken over so? And, we do know that it is a billion-dollar industry. That's with a B, not a M, a billion-dollar industry. And I don't know, I'm a retired school teacher. What I noticed in my last years of teaching, and that was 7 years ago, was that there were more children with all kinds of diseases. There was more asthma, there was more, and this is, you know, anyway, there was more asthma, there was more Asperger's, there was more of so much. And it has to do, I think, with our environment. And I just think that this treated seed option, and for farmers, and I'm sure some of the other people in the audience would know more about, you know, yields. Oh, the other thing, one of the things that happens, too, with the treated seed programs and the seeds being poisoned, they also kill the beneficial insects that the farmers need. You know, the parasitic wasps that used to kill some of those bugs and the other things. And when they used crop rotation, they didn't have as many problems with critters, with pests. So those are some of the issues. I don't know a whole lot about farming, so I can't say much more. But I know that there are some serious questions, and that the regulation part, if it needs to be regulated, then shouldn't it be? I mean, if that's what they find, I mean, it seems like to me that's what feels like such a wise thing to have. We have this Department of Agriculture, and why are we afraid to let them do their job? If something needs to be regulated, and that's not even proof that it does, but we're just asking to know what's being used, and they're able to do that with other pesticides. Why can't they do it with this very impactful treated seed program?
Whatever's done should be based on science, I would agree.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I would move to adopt the DE2 amendment. Oh, ma'am, okay. I didn't see. Go ahead.
Sorry, I showed up late.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. My name's Erin Roop. I was going to testify to you all on Thursday. I have a statement from Dan Whitney, who's president of the Honey Producers, and just got his okay to read it to you all. So thank you for adding me in. So here's Dan's statement. And I think I haven't testified before you all this year. Dan Whitney is in Texas right now. He's raising queens for his operation. Commercial beekeepers are not in the state for their job right now. Most folks are in almonds, pollinating almonds, as you've heard testimony already today. So here's Dan's statement. The MHPA, Minnesota Honey Producers Association, supports the portion of the proposed treated seed bill that involves the tracking of treated seed purchased for use in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota's beekeepers understand that farmers need to protect their crops and investments. On the other hand, research shows that the long-term sublethal levels of exposure to neonicotinoids negatively affects honeybee health. Establishing a baseline to determine how many pounds of treated seed are purchased and sown annually is necessary towards achieving a common-sense solution to Minnesota's pollinator crisis. Possible solutions must be based on good science. This position is consistent with MHPA's policy of supporting research and education that improves the health of our bees and strengthens our state's small but vital honeybee industry. Thank you for your consideration. Dan Whitney, President, MHPA. And then Chair Anderson, in response to your question about colony loss numbers, I shared with you and with Mark a little bit of basis for those numbers. So earlier this week, some background. The National Agricultural Statistics Survey started tracking honeybee colony losses quarterly just in 2015. And that's something that... I did some research just now, so learn more about it. It was part of the White House's Pollinator Health Task Force, their national strategy to promote the health of honeybees and other pollinators. And so they surveyed 3,300 beekeeping operations with five or more colonies quarterly. And to qualify for that survey, a beekeeper had to meet the definition of a farm, so a place that sold or would normally have sold $1,000 of agricultural product per year. So that's where this data came from. And you were right that in Minnesota in 2015, the highest quarter of bee losses percentage-wise was in the summer. So, I shared that report and that data with the rest of you, too. I'm sorry I don't have printouts on that now. Sorry, this is all kind of in different spots. Yeah, So that, I just wanted to clarify that, too. And then as a final point, as me, Aaron, so this language doesn't place any regulation on farmers, and the language would allow the MDA the authority to regulate. And from the testimony you've heard today, there's an impetus to support farmers in stewarding the land for pollinators, and this bill could help with that. And you're right. So you mentioned that seed corn is treated out of the state, Chair Anderson, and safe to say ballpark 95%. And I would ask that the MDA, we invite them to speak to see if that ballpark figure is enough for them. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody from the department care to comment on my wild guesstimate of the amount of seed that's treated? See how far off I am. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, Matt Wallman. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I farm as well, and I know that a lot of the seed is treated in Minnesota. But to say with definitive a response to your question of 95% or not, I don't know, because we don't have a seed treatment program here in Minnesota that accounts for those numbers. I think, the testimony that was provided today, I thought was well done. I think the important piece here is we're not looking to ban seed treatments in Minnesota. We're looking to provide the data and the science and the understanding, the education and the outreach to farmers to make good stewardship decisions about how they can use these products, but also to make sure that the products are used in a way that protects our producers and protects our pollinator communities. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would just say I don't know the answer to that question. And that's what we're hoping to achieve with this pollinator program. And I would hope that through this process we can continue to have a dialogue about this and figure out a way of how we can move forward.
But Mr. Woolman, and again, I put out that number as my guess, but couldn't your department check with the companies that sell seed corn in the state? I know they have records of how much of each variety or how much of this or that they sell in the state, and I suspect they could give you a pretty good number as to how much of the seed they sold had the chemical on it. Would you agree with that or not?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, I'm sure that the seed companies could give us a pretty good example of, you know, how much of their seed is being treated. But to what extent are they being treated? You know, we don't know anything about the seed treatment. How much active material is being applied to those seeds? We don't know that.
Okay. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I think the treatment program, you made the comment earlier that you hope that we proceed looking at science. And at least I don't think science is a guess or a pretty good number. And I think that it's important that we know more information. If we had labels that told us what the ingredients were on the seeds that provided this treatment, whether you thought it was good or bad, we'd have a better idea for our farmers to know what they're purchasing when they get their seeds. I think it makes sense to do some research and find out what's going on with the seed treatment.
I would just add that I think the labels are pretty specific in terms of the strength of what is either put in a chemical, pesticide, or in this case, a seed treatment. But anyway, care to testify, sir? Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Ken Ostley. I'm a professor and extension entomologist at the University of Minnesota. When I first arrived at the University of Minnesota, working with corn insects, one of the issues were seed feeding insects that posed a challenge for growers. A variety of those do attack corn, wireworms, white grubs, seed corn maggots, and the list goes on. The reason I bring that up is that corn and soybeans differ dramatically in how they respond to stand loss, and protecting stand is crucial with corn, and that yield is linearly related to reduction in stand. So the better you can protect that stand, the more secure your yield will be. The unfortunate thing with seed feeding insects is that there are no remedial opportunities. You plant it, if it's attacked, it's gone. And so over time, there's been this emphasis on seed protecting insecticides as an insurance policy to ensure a good stand. When I first started, we were using things like diazinon, which is an organophosphate that's frowned upon at EPA because of the nervous system properties of that product. Another very common one was lindane. Lindane is a distant chemical relative of DDT and persisted as one of the primary seed treatments up until the early 90s. So when the neonics came out, and it was found that the combination of their toxicity to seed feeding insects and systemic properties early in the season could do a better job at protecting plants and greater efficacy against seed feeding insects. And the real bonus was in the tox screening that was done at that time in the environmental properties and the health profile of the product, that these products were much better than the existing chemistries that were being used. And so there was a very rapid adoption of the technology. My purpose in telling you this is to put seed treatments in context. They're being used for a reason by growers. What has happened over time is that we have found out more on the pollinator side than was evident when the environmental profiles were evaluated. So I think there's growing body of evidence that we've got an issue with neonics. In seed treatments, you would think there wouldn't be much of a direct route to pollinators. You know, the seeds are planted, they're in the ground, the systemic properties are present for a short amount of time. So when you're looking at things like soybean or corn, which are the two primary targets, there's not a lot of residue present when pollinators might be foraging pollen. These are also not crops that are widely favored by pollinators. The challenge has come in that current planters, centrifill systems, where vacuum is used to move the seed, require talc as a lubricant, and that talc actually functions as an abrasive. Think of sandblasting the seed coating as it's planted, and then that dust is exhausted into the environment, and it has the potential to drift, and that's sort of why we have a route. Now, I would like part of what I liked in this bill was, as you might guess, as a researcher, was emphasis on getting potentially more research data to interpret what's really happening. You know, in a sense, we know what the exposure could do, but how are bees getting exposed? What practices can be used to remediate or mitigate that damage to bee populations, yet potentially preserve a technology that's protecting the seeds? I would sure hate to go back to diazinon and lindane. And so the question is, what are alternatives out there? And even that requires research to identify what are valid alternatives. So I'm not here to, you know, argue pro and con, but to give some context. And in that spirit, I would like to open myself up for any questions that you might have.
Thanks, Mr. Ross. Question. In one of our last meetings, I think it was a corn farmer talked about some kind of a liquid they applied to the seed to cut down on dust. Have you done any work with that, and is that effective?
Well, so for example, last year we evaluated a liquid in formulation. So it would be, instead of using the seed as a carrier, it would be applied in furrow. And so the question was, how well did that work? In my case, I was looking at it for corn rootworm control. But this year, they want to expand that work to look at wireworms. But basically, we found out that a liquid in furrow would do just as well as a seed treatment and not generate the dust issues and some of the associated problems with respect to that. So the challenge we have is that whether we call it it or not, the planter is functioning as an insecticide delivery tool, and as with a sprayer, it has the potential to create an opportunity for drift and off-target movement. And the last week we met with John Deere down in Moline, Illinois, to talk about planter design, and they were talking about a new standard that's in place that governs where the venting of these systems occurs and what kind of pressure, et cetera. And the idea was to reduce the height and diminish the airflow so that they could cut down on the potential for drift. But essentially, the engineers were saying, we need to know what to engineer, to what level to engineer this, because, you know, we've got this impact data on honeybees, but the route and how much we need to lower things to make it, you know, less impact in the environment is unknown. So at the moment, they don't know how to engineer that system to reduce, you know, that drift. And that's where the research comes in, whether you're talking about, you know, alternatives or whether you're talking about different delivery systems to try to minimize impact.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Question from Representative South. Then we have to wind up here just a minute.
Yeah, I just real quickly, one of the things that I think is important, and in this, I didn't know what he was going to say because my question was before that, but it's almost exactly on his point, and that is, are we barking at the right moon here? Are we really dealing with the right issue when we're trying to attack whether or not neonicotinoids are the devil or the problem in here? And he, I think he opened a great window, which is the delivery may be the issue more than the chemical. And I was just thinking also in the prospect, any number of times in this dialogue I've heard it's about the excess. You know, the testimony that the 5% actually ends up in the plant and 95% gets sloughed one way or the other in the system. So I think this actually is begging for research and higher level of knowledge, and I really do understand the issue of the suspicion of, you put the word regulate in front of a very successful tour right now, that it is a red flag. I think that the sensitivity of this, though, falls to us to at least allow things like these kinds of research things that are not in the main, in the normal box. Because at the time we thought we had dead bees because we used this stuff, and we never thought about what are all the increments of the place that this actually could be done. And I think that his testimony showed that there's just a step that has been had in that way. You also postulated that chemical companies could quite easily tell us. I think I can quickly say what at least my naive brain would say is that that's a trade secret, because they don't necessarily want to deliver the percentages of the product that's the magic sauce that they can sell when they're standing at the farmer's door. So either we would have to provide some sort of blind confidentiality for their product, as we did the research that tore it apart, or else we're just not going to get the information, because they'll go hide behind the trade secret right away. I've seen it any number of times in my life, and you've got to give them that absolute confidentiality and security before you're going to get the information.
Thanks, Representative. But my comment had to do with the strength of a product. In my example would be Roundup, for example, a common chemical. You can get Roundup with 2 pounds of active ingredient, 3 pounds, 4 pounds, to make it stronger. And that's where I was going to with the sea treatment, the strength of it. I had thought that they would that would be part of the label as far as the strength, but I could be wrong. Anyway, it's about that time. We need to act on this. Yes. Mr. Ostley, welcome back for a quick comment.
This is just Ken Ostley, University of Minnesota. This is just a clarification to build on what you were talking about, and what you were talking about.
We need to wrap this up quickly, so
right.
Go ahead.
So, by law, seed is labeled as to not all the minute ingredients in a seed treatment, but it is labeled by the insecticide, fungicide, etc. that's in it, because those are pesticides. And so every bag of seed comes with a label that says it has poncho at a rate of 250 milligrams per kilogram, or 500, or 1250. So the seed dealers know which hybrids they were selling. They know what the rates are. So I think in answer to your earlier question, you could begin to compile kind of an idea of what's being used.
Okay, thank you very much. I move to adopt the DE2 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. Thank you. And amendments to the DE2 are due by 10:15 tomorrow morning. And we'll be back on Thursday in the Ag Policy Committee. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.